So, hello and welcome back to the second part of this lecture on the global marketplace. I gave you a few facts and some reflections in the first part of this lecture about the growth of the global economy of commodity exchange investment and some of the causes of inequality. Obviously, I can only offer place markers in lectures of this kind. But feel free to post questions, comments, ideas that you might have on Canvas, and we can continue the discussion there. In this part of the lecture, I'm moving swiftly on to the era of overheating, the contemporary world in which we live today, or perhaps one should say in which we lived until March 2020, because nobody knows what globalization is going to look like when the dust settles and the pandemic is gone. But it has certainly slowed down in a dramatic way. So let's move on. Economic globalization today. As the pandemic has revealed to us, the interconnectedness and the mutual interdependence is massive. It's probably far more comprehensive and far more consequential than most of us think about in our everyday lives and the way we go about things. What will come out of it, we will have to see. The growth in world trade that I'm going to talk about has been enormous. Population growth, yes. Growth in energy consumption, yes. Growth in GDP, yeah, it's been substantial, but of course uneven. As you may know, in the United States, in the last 50 years, the poorest 50%, the lowest, as it were, 50% of the population, have pretty much been at a standstill regarding purchasing power. There hasn't been much by way of economic growth, as it were, affecting the poorest half, whereas the richest 1% have had a huge increase. I can't remember the figures now, but you can look them up if you like. A huge increase in their income. So, I mean, and on a global canvas, we're not talking about evenly distributed wealth generation, not at all. And yet, the optimists among us, one of the most famous being and most influential being the Swedish global health expert Hans Rosling, who unfortunately died a few years ago, but his book Factfulness was published with the help of two of his children a couple of years ago. And Rosling shows that, in fact, things are looking better than you may think, even for the poor. There are more people in India now who have flush toilets, for example, than ever before. Starvation is less widespread. And he has a number of other statistics which show that, in fact, even the poor people of the world, the people who are materially poor, are in many cases doing slightly better than they were a generation or two ago. Question we ask within the overheating framework is this going to last? Is it a bubble that is about to burst? Are we undermining the conditions for our own existence through over-exploitation of resources and through the coming of, and in fact the presence in many parts of the world of humanly created anthropogenic climate change? I have to go back a few decades again. Okay. Structural adjustment programs, SAPs, were introduced in the 1980s in a big way by the global financial institutions, World Bank, International Monetary Fund, with the complicity of governments, or many governments were more or less blackmailed into accepting them. So structural adjustment programs entailed the slimming down of the public sector, you know, the privatization of and deregulation of economies in order to enhance competition. The World Trade Organization, the WTO, took over from previous trade arrangements that had existed, that, for example, in many cases, offered guaranteed quotas and minimum prices for certain commodities exported by the global south or the global north. For example, I mean, one example that I think I've got in my book, in the eating book, bananas from the Caribbean. There were guaranteed quotas between the UK in some cases and between the European Union in some cases and individual Caribbean small island states. Following structural adjustment programs, these quotas were gone because everybody should now compete on a par with everybody else. And the principle that goes back to the 19th century economist David Ricardo of and famously popularized by John Stuart Mill some years later, of comparative advantage was brought to bear on the global economy as part of the structural adjustment program ideology. The comparative advantage entails that if you are producing the same commodity in location A and location B, let them compete directly, and we will then see where it makes sense to produce this particular commodity, wherever it's cheaper, wherever it's easier, wherever you can get the most in return. The problem of the comparative advantage logic on the global canvas is that small producers are at a disadvantage. So this happened to small banana producers in the Caribbean who were simply unable, as it were, so-called free market, simply unable to compete with the large plantations, large industrial, plantation types with pesticides, with machinery, with all sorts of accessories enabling them to produce bananas in larger quantities and much faster than you could if you had a small banana farm in a valley in the hilly island of Dominica, for example. We had a master project, that's why I'm mentioning Dominica, on banana farmers in Dominica and what on earth they were going to do now. Their politicians said when they were unable to sell the crops and they were in severe economic trouble, having to compete with larger banana producers elsewhere. The politicians said that you people are too lazy, you have to work harder. And between you and me, I've spent some time in the Caribbean on fieldwork and also in other capacities. And there may be some truth to that. People don't work more than they have to. I mean, that's one economic logic, which is not about profit maximization, but which is perhaps about having a good life, working just enough, but not more. So, yeah, they sat around a bit and they didn't work the farms from 8 in the morning until dusk. But the problem is, with this logic, is that this was also the situation when they were fine, when they did get guaranteed prices, quotas, and could make a living from a small banana farm. So that had not changed. What the banana farmers told our master student is that, there is a new situation of competition here, and we're simply unable to compete with those large producers. So their analysis, the banana farmers' analysis, was correct, and the politicians were misleading them. So structural adjustment programs were controversial from the beginning and are no less controversial today. But they led to a restructuring of the world economy, where a lot of power was moved away from the state to the market. That was the general idea, that the market should somehow, the invisible hand of the market, metaphor taken from the 18th century economist Adam Smith, or really a moral philosopher, but he's remembered as an economist. The invisible hand of the market would regulate it and would lead to greater prosperity, but not for everyone. Neoliberalism is a term that is being thrown about, sometimes irresponsibly, sometimes without being defined. Let me say a little bit about neoliberalism. What's neo about it? What's new about it? Liberalism can mean several things. Liberalism can be an outlook, which is liberal worldview. This is not what we're talking about here. We're talking about economic liberalism, not political liberalism, which is multi-party democracy and freedom of expression and the individual's right to decide their own destiny and so on. Not talking about political liberalism, but economic liberalism, which is free competition. Well, free competition. Because it's never free, you see, because people don't compete on the same, under the same conditions. There's a cartoon that I should have shown you, but I'll describe it to you instead. It's not as fun to describe a cartoon, which illustrates the problems of this idea of free competition. Okay, you have three people who want to watch a ball game, and they don't have a ticket, so they're going to watch it over a fence. There's a fence. One of them is very tall. He can just stand and watch, you know, over the fence. The other one is not quite as tall, but he or she can look, can peer through a hole, you see, in the fence. The third one is just a small child, and he or she just has to stand there and sees nothing. That is one way of talking about the limitations of free competition. You don't have to agree with what I say, but it's a way of thinking about free competition as, in practice, being much less free than it may seem. As the example, I think, from Dominica and the large banana plantations on the mainland shows. And talking about banana plantations in Central America, United Fruit is mentioned by Eric Wolf as an example of a corporation that eventually wields power so persuasive and so inevitable that it can control or contribute to controlling governments. So the term banana republic that you would have heard comes from, in fact, it originates in the power that United Fruit had over governments in, you know, places like Honduras in Central America, owing to their enormous economic power. So the question one may ask is it necessarily a good idea that the market should become so powerful that it comes to dominate governments? Anyway, that's you know, neoliberalism starting in the 1980s with a dual, you might say, almost revolutions, or at least a dual elections in the UK and the US, two leading actors on the global scene of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher around the same time. Thatcher 1979, Reagan 1980. And they were both strongly favourable to deregulation and were probably, as individuals, not entirely responsible, but had a huge influence on the change in economic policy in the 1980s, which we are still living with. You know, there's still few and feeble counter-reactions to the market idea, the idea that free global markets is for the best of humanity. One effect of neoliberalism, as I've already suggested, is that it in fact creates, it does produce inequality. One effect of structural adjustment programs is that it thrusts middle classes, civil servants, people who had been working in the public sector, into poverty in countries like Argentina and also elsewhere. Another effect of neoliberalism is that it also encourages homogenization, standardization, scaling up, you know, in the integrated world of neoliberal economics or in neoliberal practices, large-scale operations will tend to be favoured at the expense of small-scale operations. So things are being events, operations, companies, corporations are being scaled up. This does not mean that niches do not exist. Niches for smaller actors, but they have to find those niches and find ways of exploiting them. You know, microbreweries, for example, producing handicrafts, handcrafted beer, you know, handcrafted beer in small quantities, charming B&Bs, bed and breakfasts on some Caribbean island, which are unique, which cannot be scaled up because they're only there. Surely these exist. But the big picture is that, and you see that in statistics over the largest corporations in the world, that the bigger the better, you know. Amazon, Google, Apple, and a couple of more corporations are completely dominating the cybernetic, the digital sphere. I am using software for these lectures from a smaller producer, by the way, probably a niche producer of some kind. But they're hoping also, like everybody else, for a world takeover. So let me say just a couple of words about financialization. Read Bill Maurer and read him carefully, because his article that you got on your reading list is a really compact, condensed, and, you know, information. It's chock full of information. Really a very knowledgeable overview of the anthropology of financialization. Financialization seems very abstract and difficult to grasp, and that's exactly what it is. It is about the shift of the, you might say, the gravitational point of the economy from stuff, you know, producing stuff, to financial instruments, money relating to money. And where the wealth of a company is no longer chiefly tied up to its assets, you know, its material assets. How many cars do you have, for example, in your storerooms, in your warehouses, and on the docks? It's about expectations and psychology, mass psychology. How much do people believe that this company is worth? So if the American president, now the current president cannot really be reckoned in this, or maybe he can, gives a speech where he says something unexpected, that would have effect, direct effects on the stock exchange, because it would affect expectations as to how the economy will develop in the future. So financialization is about shifting gravitational point of the economy from the material to the virtual. And Bill Maurer has an interesting comment about this somewhere in his chapter, where he speaks about the end of the Bretton Woods arrangement. Now, Bretton Woods, which is a village in New Hampshire, actually, where there was an important meeting towards the end of the Second World War, where representatives of the major powers, who by then knew that they were going to win the war, okay, they were laying out the foundations for the post-war economy. And Bretton Woods reintroduced something which had been around on and off for centuries, namely the gold standard. The gold standard, which means that hard currency, because there were hard currencies and there were unhard currencies, there were convertible currencies and non-convertible currencies. As a boy, suddenly I found myself with 200 Sudanese pounds in my pocket, because I've been traveling in Africa with my family, and somehow I had 200 Sudanese pounds, which wasn't a lot of money. And I tried to change it, okay? I came back to Norway and tried to change it in the bank. They wouldn't take it because it was not convertible currency. It was only a legal tender in Sudan, probably because it was not connected to the gold standard. And on the old banknotes from Britain, pound notes from Britain, it would say that this legal tender can be exchanged for gold. So if you went into the bank and insisted, "I want gold for this," it was there was a fixed exchange rate between gold and currency. After 1972-73, as Bill Maurer points out, the Bretton Woods order was abandoned. Probably the most important thing that President Nixon did, more important than Watergate, more important than the Vietnam War, was to start the process and to decide that the American dollar should no longer be directly linked with the amount of gold in Fort Knox, you know, where they kept their and keep their gold reserves. So instead of having a menu that relates directly to food, you know, money relates directly to material value, which is gold, you suddenly had a menu that related to other menus. As my colleague Tian Seud has once said, who's been keenly interested in and who's written really good stuff on money and what money is, we start to eat the menu and it tastes pretty good. That's financialization, at least one way of talking about it. Volatility, not much to say about that now, because I have a few other things I'd like to say before the end of this lecture. Volatility is about, you know, the unpredictability basically of the world economy and the way in which it is, it's so abstract and so complex that it's very hard to predict anything at all. The financial crisis of 2007-2008 had not been predicted by anyone, and some economists agreed afterwards, you know, they admitted that it was impossible for us to see this coming. Nobody had thought so. We thought that growth would just continue forever, and it didn't. Okay, let's move quickly on from financialization, but read Bill Moran and ask me questions on Canvas if there's anything you'd like to discuss. Informality and the precariat. So now we're moving, now finally, down, beginning sort of to move down into the substance of people's lives in this global marketplace. Informality is a term that was introduced by the English anthropologist I mentioned in the previous session, Keith Hart, when he was doing fieldwork in the markets in Accra, Ghana, doing sort of a bit of fieldwork, intermittent fieldwork, because he was really hired by an international organization to do reports on development, on economic development. And he discovered, or rather, he of course he knew, but he started to think about the implications of the fact that in the markets of Accra, there was a lot of trade going on. People selling and buying stuff continuously. Little trinkets, foodstuffs, drinks, meals, clothes, and so on. But none of it went through a cash register. There were no receipts. There was no official way of calculating the value of these transactions. So this set him off on the journey, which has lasted until the present, on exploring the informal sector, which is that which is not registered, it's not accounted for, it's invisible, it doesn't show on GDP, it's exempt from taxes because nobody knows what it is. A lot of the informality that economists write about is illegal things, I mean, crime, basically, smuggling, drug dealing, prostitution, etc. But quite a bit of the, I mean, a very large proportion, I mean, of the economies in many countries in the global south is, in fact, informal. It was calculated at the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic that maybe as much as 70 to 80% of the Indian workforce technically works informally, which means that they have no labor contract, you know, they have no, as it were, formal agreements with their employer, and they get their payment up front in cash. So it's not really directly accounted for. So the term informality that is being used, not least in the global north, has maybe limited applicability in the global south, in parts of the global south, where the entire society is informal. And let me give you a short anecdote to illustrate this. Not the entire economy, but most of it. I mean, when I was in Accra, quite recently, same city as Keith Hart had been nearly 50 years earlier, I walked into a petrol station to buy a cold drink, okay? Pepsi Max. Petrol station, global chain. I mean, it was Shell or Esso or something. And there was a brand new cash register on the till. But the lady took my money, opened the drawer, and there were lots of banknotes there already, okay? Put my banknote into the drawer, took out a bit of change and gave me the change. So in other words, this transaction took place outside of any ways of, you know, accounting, registering. It would not be visible on the accounts. So that made me think that, you know, when a petrol station, which belongs to a global chain, when they operate informally in their transactions, where are the formal transactions? Well, I soon learned where they were. They were, for example, in a hotel where I was staying, where I got a printed receipt. But you see what I mean. The precariat is a term which is somehow related to informality. You've been asked to read a piece by Guy Standing on the precariat. He's an English economist, it's a very interesting economist. Among other things, he's been promoting universal basic income and written a book about it. A very readable book about universal basic income. And the term the precariat, it's subtitled The New Dangerous Class, because you see, at the time of early industrialism, in the 19th century in Britain, the working class were considered a dangerous class because they could go on strike and they were unruly and they were somehow ungovernable and they could be violent and they would riot in the streets if they didn't get their way. So the elites considered them dangerous. But some of them were also dangerous in other ways. Coal miners were dangerous because they could simply stop the energy supply in society. Coal miners were very powerful. And coal miners are key to understanding the force of the labour movement as it emerged towards the end of the 19th century. So the precariats are people who are not steadily employed. They may have temporary jobs. They may be moving in and out of a job, but they don't have a fixed job that they can rely on for the next, you know, 10 years or more. And what Guy Standing says is that we are witnessing in the global north now a precaritization of the labor force, in the sense that fewer and fewer have lifelong, as it were, fixed jobs that they can rely on. They have temporary contracts. A growing part of the working population would be part of what is sometimes spoken of as gig economy. The gig economy, you sell your services as a freelancer. So you sell something, but you don't get a fixed monthly salary. You're only paid a piece for whatever it is that you're able to supply. And Standing sees this way of organizing labor and work as a tendency, which is becoming more and more widespread. And you may have examples of that yourself from your own life, so people you know who take part in that sort of economy. Sometimes spoken of euphemistically as flexibility. You become so flexible. Yeah, I guess people are flexible, but it's not the case that people always want to be flexible. I mean, I spoke about flexibility last week as a theoretical term, the options for change, the options you have for doing something different, the uncommitted potential for change. So you have a lot of flexibility if you have nothing to do because you can do anything. But maybe you don't always want flexibility. Just as creativity is not something that we will always want. You don't want a creative dentist. Or if you take a flight, you don't want a creative pilot. And similarly with flexibility, flexibility can just be a nice way of talking about insecurity. So that's where the precariat comes in. In an overheated world where there is so rapid change, there is less security. Right? There is less security because you've no idea what the world will look like in 5 years. And how can I employ someone in a fixed position full time when I don't even know if my company or my office will exist in another few years? So there's a drive towards precarization of the labor force. Okay, let's move on quickly. Yes, Yes, I've already said a little bit about this, but let me say a few more things. Finance, the magic of finance, how a pound can give birth to a 10 pence coin all by itself, just by sitting there. So Mora has some examples. She has a rather nice case, and I think you should remember that case from Michael Taussig, an anthropologist who worked in Colombia, and in a very famous book at the time, very influential book that was published in 1980, he wrote about the devil and commodity fetishism in his field. The people that Taussig worked with thought that some kind of magic had to be involved when money could simply grow by itself, because the concept of interest that we're so accustomed to, you know, interest, because you put money in your bank and you get interest from it, is alien in traditional societies. And compound interest, that I've spoken about, is even more strange. So some people in Taussig's material might believe that if you just performed the correct rites, you had a banknote, and you performed certain rites, that banknote would eventually multiply. Right? It's very abstract, but think about it. It's not self-evident that money can grow by itself without any intervening action. It is mystical, and it resembles magic. And it's capitalism. I already mentioned the Marx quotation, "All that is solid melts into air." So he saw this quite early in his work in the mid-19th century, that the economy is becoming more and more abstract. And in the end, you just get money relating to other money, and it somehow grows. That's the beginnings of the financial economy that he was commenting on. So if you don't believe in overheating, take a look at this. The value of global export. Yeah, there's a blip, okay, around 2008, 2009. But we know why. It's because of the global financial crisis. And it has picked up since then. Now the figures for 2020 will look very different. But let's bracket 2020 for now. And just look at it. The value of global exports, it's grown rather healthily, I'd say. Rather fast. And not least since the onset of overheating around 1990. I mean, you have an enormous growth. So we're talking about a fourfold growth in global trade since 1980. And next week, Johanna Markula will talk to you about the container ship, which is, you know, a key actor in this story. Just as a plantation is a key actor in the story about global inequality, and which should clearly be taken into account if you want to understand racism in the United States and elsewhere. Race disparities, the inequality of class associated with race, goes back to the plantation, just as this phenomenon of plantation is necessary in order to understand the current global economy. We need to understand the container ship in order to make sense of this graph, value of global exports, because containerization led to an enormous reduction in transportation costs and the standardization. Right? Everything had to be fitted into a shipping container. Everybody had to produce shipping containers which had exactly the same dimensions. So whether you were Hanjin in Korea or Maersk in Denmark, two of the largest actors for many years until Hanjin went bankrupt, and Maersk is the largest container container ship owner in the world. You had to produce containers which were exactly the same dimension, same size, same amount of stuff fitted into them. And the ports were being rebuilt to suit the requirements of the new container ship technology. So that's in order to understand the growth in world trade and global exports. It's not enough to look at the deregulation of the Chinese economy or the deregulation and investment into the Indian economy. although these things are important, but for them to get the stuff around, to get it exported, to get it sold at a price that was acceptable, we need to understand the importance of the container ship. Now, at the end, I'll give you just two examples of ways in which we can think about the global marketplace from below. One way is by following a commodity from its inception. You know, you could follow a t-shirt from the cotton fields in West Africa to the recycling bin in Zambia, you know, via production, you know, weaving, dyeing, sales in some shop in Oslo. I wear the t-shirt for a few years, then I have to tidy up my cupboard because it's overflowing with clothes that I never wear. So I give it, you know, to some charity. They send it off to Africa. It's being sold in an outdoor market in Lusaka, and it's being used until it's threadbare. And when it's so threadbare that it's no longer and filthy, that it's no longer usable, maybe they cut it up and use the parts of the t-shirt as rags, you know, to you know, clean their house or whatever, or polish the bicycle. And when the rags are falling apart, either they're burnt or they are recycled. You know, you can tell these stories. And this book by Caroline Knowles, you're reading another article about her from the rubbish dump in Addis Ababa that we're going to talk about in a few weeks. But I recommend this book if anybody is interested in this sort of thing and has the time. It's very well written and it's engrossing. And it starts in the oil fields in Kuwait or somewhere in the Middle East because plastic is made of oil. And it then makes its way to a chemical factory in South Korea, a factory or two in China, you know, where the actual shaping of the flip-flops are being made, shipped out. Remember, the flip-flop is the most widespread footwear in the world. I don't know how many billion. There are probably more flip-flops than there are smartphones. You've got a pair or two. I've got a pair or two, you know. In many parts of the world, it is the footwear that you have. You don't have anything but a pair of flip-flops. So they're being sold somewhere in Africa eventually, after I'm being distributed by a larger company, maybe in South Africa, and are being worn and so on and so forth, before they end up finally totally worn out in the rubbish dump, for example, in Addis Ababa. One way of thinking about globalization from below, following a product through its different phases. And another example that you've also, this one you've got in your readings, the flip-flop, I don't think you have, maybe it's mentioned, you don't have the proper story, is one of the many new Silk Roads leading out from China. So this building is part of the Chongqing Mansions in Hong Kong. Rather large, ramshackle, multi-storied. It contains hotels and restaurants, but mainly it contains shops. Chongqing Mansions, according to Gordon Matthews, who works, you know, he's an anthropologist who works in Hong Kong and has done so for many years. Not only works in the sense of doing fieldwork, but he works at the university in Hong Kong. According to him, a very large percentage, maybe as much as 40% of the mobile phones sold in Africa at a particular juncture had been bought by wholesale traders in Chongqing Mansions. So we have African traders. Now, this is a number of years ago, so it would have changed. The stats would be different now. But the trade still goes on. In some Chinese cities, there are areas which are devoted to itinerant traders from Africa and the Middle East, where you can get halal food, for example, because many of them are Muslim, okay? Where there are boarding houses that cater exclusively to these foreign traders. So there's a whole cottage industry that has grown up around this itinerant trade with Africans and people from elsewhere, but mainly Africans in parts of China. So the Chinese, the African trader comes to Chongqing Mansions. He buys up a large number of mobile phones, makes his way back to Africa and sells them either to shops or directly to consumers. So in order to understand the spread of the internet in Africa, you've got to know something about Chongqing Mansions and the way in which trade works, you know, with these African traders coming in and out. I've no idea what this looks like now, autumn 2020, owing to the COVID-19 pandemic. So this is one of many globalization from below, many economic activities on a micro scale, which somehow pass under the radar in many cases, but which have huge consequences, enormous consequences for the people affected. Lots of people in Africa will not be able to access the internet. Lots of people will not have an income because they're no longer able to travel there. And the wholesalers who are running the shops in Chongqing Mansions would sit around and drink tea and look at their watch and wondering when the next customer shows up. So the ramifications, the interrelations and the connections and the complexities and the way in which Chongqing Mansions is connected to a village in Botswana. I find that, you know, it's important and it's a key to understanding globalization and overheating, because these thin little filaments, which seem insignificant, when you add them up, and there are billions of them, they create a world which is crisscrossed, totally crisscrossed with networks connecting us to each other. Okay, yes, I see my time is running out. I should have spoken about some, but let me just list them. We can discuss this on Canvas as well, if you like. Resistance against the homogenization, the way, the feeling that you are being overrun by the forces of globalization. And where people ask themselves, who can I trust and who can I blame? What can I do to improve my situation if I feel that I'm being overrun and I'm being exploited and I'm being messed up by powerful corporations, and the scale of gap is such that it's impossible for me to even see the CEO without the use of a telescope, so I can't address them with my complaints. So we have some examples of resistance, indigenous groups, not least in South America, who try to shield themselves, protect themselves from some of the forces of overheated globalization, not least by developing alternative ideologies and practices of development and of the good life. You have this movement in the Andes called Buen Vivir, living well, Buen Vivir, which posits an alternative path to the good life, fairly relatively independent of the Western logic of global capitalism. Post-socialist Europe. Yes, I mean, there is resistance there as well. Nationalism. The rise of what we sometimes speak of as populism in the West, where again people, but on a larger scale, try to shield themselves, protect themselves against these sort of flows that they feel are detrimental to their well-being. And then you have climate activists. I don't have to say more about those because you know them, who also resist and resent and react to and criticize. But on the whole, the stories that I have told today, those are the, let's not fool ourselves into believing otherwise, those are the main stories. Those are the stories of the contemporary world. And it is a story of simplification. You have to, if you want to standardize, standardization, simplification, these are two sides of the same coin. You have to simplify work operations, and accumulation, which is a drive, you know, growth, better this year than last year, more this year than last year, make people produce faster and consume more efficiently. acceleration follows from this. Do things faster and more efficiently. That is the, you might say, a core value of the contemporary world of production, distribution, and consumption. And it's a double-edged sword, and it's complicated to get with grips with. But at least now we've got started, and I'm looking forward not to seeing you next week, because then you will be seeing Johanna Markula, who will be speaking about container ships. But in a couple of weeks' time, when I'm going to talk, going to sort of build on these things, I'm trying, you know, the idea about this course is that it should be cumulative, okay? So in order to understand lecture 4 on cities fully, you have to watch lecture 2 first. And in order to understand lecture 2, you will realize that in lecture 2, the lecture makes some references to lecture 1. So we're trying to make it cumulative. Okay? On that note, thank you for your attention. See you on Canvas, and certainly see you in a couple of weeks' time.